Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 307, recorded September 7th, 2018. Embracing the Power of AI. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by JW Player, the most powerful and flexible video platform enabling businesses, including Twit.tv, to customize the video experience on their website. To learn more and get 50% off your business subscription, visit jwplayer.com/twit and use code TWIT at checkout. And by IT Pro TV, flexible and entertaining training for your IT career. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise and use code ENTERPRISE30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And by Grammarly, the communication tool that helps you improve your writing for every occasion. Start writing more confidently for work, school, and even on the go. It's a great way to double check your important papers, documents, and even avoid future typos. Get 20% off Grammarly Premium today at grammarly.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of enterprise. But who can guide you by yourself, by myself? I need a little help from some of the juggernauts in the industry, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin, the senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend?
So far, so good, Lou. I'm having a good day here in Florida. We haven't washed away yet and been researching lots of interesting things, including lots of things about machine learning and artificial intelligence as they pertain to security. Got some great stuff coming out next week and lots and lots of headache-inducing information rolling around my noggin.
Fantastic. Now, I actually just read your Lessons from the Black Hat Knock. That was a cool article. Everyone should go check that out because there's some kind of internal information about how things are run there. Very cool.
Well, thank you, folks, sir.
Yeah.
I was going to say hanging out in Knox is one of the best parts of this job, whether it's at Interop, Black Hat, or, well, pretty much any other show that'll have me.
Yeah, great stuff. Great stuff. Well, folks, we also couldn't do the show without Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, how are you? You're staying away from, you're actually latching things down by you as well?
Yeah, it's funny. We have a conga line stretching through the Central Pacific. I think we have like 3 or 4 hurricanes going from here to Baja. Of course, I was supposed to have a conference call this last, Monday or Tuesday. That got postponed because my partner was in Mississippi and they were getting hit by a hurricane. What's going on?
I have no idea. Well, just at least stay safe. And if we see you go dark, we'll try to give you a call back. But well, folks, we actually have a pretty great set of topics today. We're going to talk about the Lifeline program and also about drones in the enterprise. But we also have a great guest talk about AI and data analytics and how it's helping with better relationships with customers. But first, like we always do, let's jump into the blips. Now, you're probably curious about the next big thing in technology, right? Well, according to Gartner, we recently reported that the 5 trends of emerging markets, and one of the big emerging technologies was called knowledge graphs. Now, what are they? Well, these graphs allow for customers to query massive, diverse, heterogeneous data, regardless of structure, and actually create analytics off of it. Now, to date, one of the leaders in this space has been Stardog, which customers from name brand companies in finance, healthcare, life sciences, energy, media, and government. But there is a new player in town, and that's Diffbot. Now, their claim is that they are the world's largest structured enterprise-ready database of human knowledge ever created. Now, according to the company, the Diffbot knowledge graph is 500 times larger than Google's own knowledge graph and growing autonomously every day. Now, managing and curating that amount of data involves the use of machine learning, computer vision, and natural language processing, with the service built specifically to provide knowledge as the end product, paid for and owned by the customer. Now, as we talk more about data and machine learning and AI in this episode, you'll notice a trend. The industry is realizing that in order to build great businesses and organizations, you need to unlock the meaning of your data and give organizations instant access to deep connections that can change the way we work.
Well, it turns out that the best high-tech answer to election security might just be paper. A new report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine is recommending the use of human-readable paper ballots as the best way to protect the security and integrity of U.S. elections, at least in the near term. The committee behind the report wants election officials to consider ditching voting methods that do not provide a reliable paper-verifiable audit trail as early as the upcoming 2018 midterms and for all local, state, and federal elections by 2020. Further, it doesn't want jurisdictions to permit the use of the internet and internet-connected systems to return marked ballots until, quote, very robust guarantees, end quote, of security and verifiability are developed. Now, Lee Bollinger, president of Columbia University and co-chair of the committee that developed the report, said, and I quote, paper ballots are evidence that cannot be manipulated by faulty software or hardware, and they can be used to audit and verify the results of an election, end quote. Now, five states, Delaware, New Jersey, Georgia, Louisiana, and South Carolina, currently vote exclusively on machines that do not support a paper record. In a report this July, the Committee on House Administration categorized these states as being exposed to the most critical election security vulnerabilities. A survey conducted at Black Hat by security vendor Lastline found 84% of the respondents there saying that there will be some sort of hacking during the 2018 midterms, and about 54% believed it would happen at a national level, while 47% expect disruption at the state level with the goal of influencing those state-level elections.
Well, you know, to make the web safer, Google says URLs have to die. The problem with URLs is that they're difficult to understand, and hackers prey on this confusion to launch malicious sites, initiate phishing attacks, disseminate false information, or spread malicious software. A recent McAfee report suggested cyber attacks cost the world $600 billion, that's billion with a B, last year, and the number of attacks are rising. Quote, so we want to move towards a place where web identity is understandable by everyone. They know who they're talking about when they're talking to when they're using a website, and they can reason about whether they can trust them, said Google Chrome engineering manager Adrian Porter Felt, in an interview with Wired magazine. Quote, but this will mean big changes in how and when Chrome displays URLs. We want to challenge how URLs should be displayed and question it as we're figuring out the right way to convey identity. You know, my favorite example of how dangerous URLs could be is whitehouse.com versus whitehouse.gov, with one being what we expect and the other a porn site. The bottom line is that Google is really questioning how people use browsers and are actively looking for ways to make web browsing safer.
So most cities are expanding their online presence, but even without it, it doesn't stop citizens from discussing their towns. Now, they discuss the goods and bads of their region on social media, forums, and the comment sections of posts and news. Now, I can tell you, in my town, several Facebook pages exist, and if all walks of life come on there and talk about the praise and the smack at the same time. Now, what if the city officials could get insights onto what's going on and get a better idea of what the citizens care about? Well, that's where Zen City comes in. They are an Israeli-based startup that analyzes online conversations and reports trends and sentiments to city officials. Now, their aggregators actually link feedback and comments from multiple sources, including social networks, news websites, and municipal hotlines, and applies artificial intelligence to help extract meaningful, structured data for city planners and managers to tackle the issues that are most pertinent to their residents in their area. Now, as a part of the package, they also create reports and dashboards that are easy to ingest by officials, even for people who are not data analysts or technologists. Now, last October, Microsoft launched the $3.5 million Innovate.ai competition for AI startups, and Zen City was actually the Israeli region winner. If nothing else, this will help with smarter, more informed cities. Now we just have to get them to actually take action, too.
NIST has issued a draft report on improving BGP And surprisingly, it does not call for any new hardware. A new draft publication from the NIST National Cybersecurity Center of Excellence takes aims at security concerns about the Border Gateway Protocol, or BGP, which is the default routing protocol that routes traffic among internet domains. Draft SP1800-14 was developed in cooperation with AT&T, CenturyLink, Cisco, Comcast, Juniper, Palo Alto Networks, and the George Washington University. It describes route origin validation, or ROV, a technique intended to shield BGP routers and the routes they advertise from an attack known as route hijacking, in which bad guys advertise a malicious route which sends traffic to illegitimate servers, illegitimate routers, or both. Rather than describing new technology, the paper describes, quote, how networks can protect BGP routes from vulnerability to route hijacks by using available security protocols, products, and tools to perform BGP ROV to reduce route hijacking threats. It's great to see. Now, this is the first draft of this, and comments are out there until October 15th, but I think this has real promise as a way to reduce the security issues with one of the foundation protocols of the internet.
That's pretty cool. Anyway, Wikipedia is looking for photos of the 20 million artifacts lost in a Brazilian museum fire. What folks at Wikipedia are counting on is our human curiosity and our tendency to want to share our vacation pictures. Just look on Google Earth at the Eiffel Tower in Paris or St. Peter's Square in Rome to see the amazing collection of user-contributed images shot at the famous landmarks. So what Wikipedia is counting on is that past visitors of this famous museum will also be willing to crowdsource their memories of the lost artifacts. I do, however, wonder why the curators didn't already have their exhibit documentation duplicated off-site. Don't we all say that data doesn't really exist until it exists in at least three places? So, since Twiat seems to reach every continent on Earth, how about we ask our viewers to see if their photo collection includes some snaps from the Museo Nacional in Rio.
Now, Google has the goals to make use of more than just search data. They want to unlock all kinds of data sets worldwide to assist studies, research, and help data scientists gain insights into new and emerging areas of the industry. Now, how are they going to do this? Well, with their new service called Dataset Search. Now, how does this work? Well, institutions that publish their data online, such as universities and governments, will need to actually include metadata tags into their web pages that describe their data. Now, this metadata includes who created it, when it was published, and how it was collected. So this does require a bit of work on the data provider side. That's not just some random data that they're indexing. But the information found in the metadata tags will help Dataset Search index the data and combine it with input from Google's knowledge graph. Now, numerous companies are looking to create graphs of data from your organization's data from within the boundaries of your data stores and service, but Google's trying to expand those walls to a graph of linked and possibly related data from all over the world. Now, the initial release of Dataset Search will cover the environmental and social sciences and government data and data sets from news organizations like ProPublica. Now, the interesting part here is the metadata tags are visible to all search engine crawlers as an open standard. Now, we might find that Google might not be the only player in indexing of curated data sets soon. Let's bring on the competition. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Let's next up is the bites. But first, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's JW Player. Now, everyone watches videos online, and if it works well in the player, you don't even notice which player is actually playing the video. Now, if you look closer, you will notice that it's most likely JW Player. Now, I've actually built a ton of front ends in my time, and I can tell you that JW Player is one of the most flexible and feature-rich HTML5 players in the business. It's easy to integrate and customize, as well as it adheres to your site's design and customizations. And the features are pretty awesome, too. Now, if it's time for you to grow up from YouTube, JW Player has you covered. The spectrum goes from casual YouTubers all the way up to large-scale publishers and broadcasters who want to maximize their video ad fill rates and CPMs. Now, if you visit the Twit website, you probably notice that even when you watch an episode on that site, it uses JW Player. Now, as Leo says, it's one of the most important features of the Twit website with quick access to any show right on the site's and it's critical to Twit's business, and JW Player gets out of the way and lets Twit shine. Now, Twit's not the only one who's using this awesome player. Now, top websites and publishers like the Washington Post, Business Insider, and Vice are all able to customize the JW Player for their needs. Now, the JW Player was able to integrate into their brands really easily and seamlessly, and it's able to adhere to their designs as well. Now, if you're ready to take control of your video experience, here is what JW Player can bring to the table. Now, it offers buffer-free technology, makes it one of the fastest players, a fully customizable player to match your brand, video CMS to manage the uploads of videos, and plus they offer APIs to help enhance the experience and integrate into your site's functionality. Plus, if you're running ads, this player will help you max out your fill rates and CPMs. To me, if you're serious about offering content, JW Player is the way to go. Visit jwplayer.com/twit and use the code TWIT at checkout to get a 50% off your business subscription. This is a limited time exclusive offer for twit.tv listeners, so be sure to check it out today. That's jwplayer.com/twit and use the code TWIT at checkout. And we thank JW Player for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. All right, well, let's jump into the bites. And today we have a couple topics that might strike the soapbox strings of our co-hosts. Now, some of you heard of the Lifeline program, and this program is great at providing discounts on phone services for low-income consumers. Now, it helps ensure people have the opportunity and security that phone service brings, including being able to connect jobs, family, and emergency services. Now, the Lifeline program is available to eligible low-income consumers in every state, territory, commonwealth, and on tribal lands. Now, the FCC determines which carriers can be members of this program. It's designated by their breakdown of ETC, or eligible telecom carriers. Now, here is one of the rules. Each carrier must serve 1,000-plus non-Lifeline voice and broadband customers and has offered broadband for at least 2 years straight. Now, that doesn't sound too restricting, right? Well, now here's the kicker. There was a new proposal for the program introduced last year. Now, the proposal would limit Lifeline program to providers that on their own networks. This would effectively eliminate resellers or providers who instead lease space on a network. Now, this didn't actually hit home until the numbers actually came out. There are roughly 10.7 million Americans using this service, and due to the new rules, 70% of them will need to find new providers. Now, that's a lot of people. Now, in the past, this program has been criticized for fraud because providers actually have financial incentives to enroll as many participants in the program as possible without actually verifying whether they're eligible or not. Now, the new proposal is voted on September 26th, so there's not much time for consumers to find other providers. All right, Cheebert, I want to throw this over to you first because if they're going to propose this, shouldn't they actually propose some kind of a transition plan off those resellers like TracFone and iWireless?
My personal opinion on this is that, you know, why are we making the subscription plans that these people are going to use more expensive? The resellers are providing a really interesting service in that they're buying very large masses of data and voice minutes and then reselling them to consumers cheaply. It would, in my mind, make more sense for the federal government to say, okay, let's just try and cut out the opportunity for fraud and encourage people to go and get the least expensive solution so that we can make the Lifeline Fund stretch further. Now, keep in mind, the Lifeline Fund is limited to $2 billion. And when you start spreading across a very, very large number of people doesn't go as far as it could. And it kind of smacks me in the head saying, hey, maybe it's the big guys, the big boys saying, hey, we're losing too much business. Why can't we get in on this pork barrel? And they're playing political games. Well, that's my two cents. That's my bit on the soapbox.
So you brought it up a little bit. You said, hey, why don't you try to reduce the amount of fraud going on? Now, how would you, if you were to say, hey, I'm going to kind of modify this program in a little bit, how would you go about actually reducing the amount of fraud there in that type of program?
My personal opinion is, why don't we go and issue, you know, digital or maybe even a QR code certificate to the people that qualify. Because you have to apply for Lifeline. You don't just say, I want it, and you get it. It's part of your benefits package from the U.S. federal government or whoever. So why can't it be, say, a QR code or something that represents a digital code, and you can't sign, you can't buy Lifeline services unless you have a certificate? You know, kind of like how they do WIC cards for, you know, food and drugs and things like that. I don't see this as being really hard. Can you see any problems with that?
All right, Curtis, I think I want to throw this over to you because I think the FCC is bringing out the big hammers here. They're saying, hey, what we're going to do is we're just going to change the program entirely. We're going to get rid of all resellers. Is this going to make things better or worse?
Well, I think it will make things worse for a lot of the people who need this service the most. You know, I saw something recently within the last week or so that pointed out once again that for many Americans, being poor is very expensive. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, many of the people who are very poor are not able to get traditional bank accounts, so they have to go to things like the check cashing services that charge fees in order to get cash, which they'll then use to do things like buy money orders, which also have fees attached to pay their bills. When you start adding complication, adding friction to the system of something like the Lifeline service, then you make it more expensive, more difficult for people to get these phones. Now, many people will say, and they're quite correct, there's no constitutional guarantee of a cell phone. And it is possible, we see it done, to live in today's society without a cell phone. But let's also admit that when these are people who we want to encourage to be more productive, more, if you will, normal members of society, often the cell phone is going to be the way that they are contacted by potential employers, by current employers, the way they stay in touch with their children's schools, the way they stay in touch with their children's after-school providers that allow them to have things like jobs. So I'm all in favor of doing things to make this as easy, as friction-free as possible for the people who are ultimately receiving the service, even if it has a bit of additional cost to the companies. Why? Largely because I'm convinced that doing so is ultimately less expensive for all of us.
Right. So this is actually an interesting part of the topic, too. You know, it's not just consumers or people that are actually angry about this potential change in policy. Cheaper, I want to throw over to you. We're actually seeing carriers actually throw their hands up and say, WTF, what's going on here? This is not right. This is not going to work.
Actually, before I jump into that, I'm actually going to repeat what Mo has said in the chat room. She points out then. Three counties around her, there actually isn't any landline availability. And when you start talking about rural America, more and more of the landline services are disappearing. And there are, shall we say, some areas in, you know, the poorer areas where some of the buildings, the copper hasn't been connected in certain buildings for a very, very long time, if it was ever done. And if you start talking about, oh, well, why don't they just use VoIP? Well, that's even worse because even in more affluent areas, places are, you know, certain buildings, you know, like the 2 and 3 story walk-ups are bypassed by broadband. Even in Honolulu, where we have two or sometimes three broadband alternatives, many buildings are passed right by. So that's one issue. And yeah, you know, a lot of these large vendors are saying, you know, WTF, it's like, okay, guys, I know you hate Lifeline because it's giving a quote, giving away your services. But if you want more customers, you need to go and make it so that the people that have trouble, you know, getting back on their feet can communicate with their employers, can communicate with the kids' schools. Sometimes that you know, a little track phone or whatever with a data plan is the only internet some of these families have. So kids are literally having to do homework assignments on a smartphone that mom or pop got at Walmart or whatever. So Lifeline is important. It needs to be policed. It needs to be cleaned up so that, you know, less fraud. I know it's a knee-jerk reaction with the FCC say, hey, Lifeline, you know, there's so much fraud, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay, fine. But you got to remember what Lifeline is intended to do. We want these people to have the resources in order to try and get back on their feet. And I'm totally in agreement with Curtis. We need to remove friction, but we also need to remove people cheating on this.
Right. So there was actually an interesting quote from Verizon who actually said restricting Lifeline support to facility-based carriers is unlikely to materially improve the business care or case for broadband deployment in high-cost areas. So that's interesting that, like you said, like a lot of these carriers are saying this is not going to help at all. I don't know. We don't know what you're doing. So we definitely don't think this will help at all. Now, I do want to kind of go on to a different topic here. Curtis, I want to throw over the question to you. Now, even though this was not meant to be discriminatory or have any discriminatory intent by the FCC, could this be perceived as such from, you know, from consumers and for people in these areas?
Well, statistically, it probably will be just because of the nature of the way economics work, the nature of the relationship between race and income level. Certain groups, African Americans and Hispanics, tend to be overrepresented statistically among the poor. So from that aspect, yes, it's going to be possible to make the argument that it is discriminatory on a racial or cultural basis. Now, personally, I think if there's discrimination going on, it's economic discrimination. We have, I'm going to drag the soapbox over, we have in this nation a certain bias against the poor, whether they are what we would call socially the deserving poor or not. And so I think that that's where the bulk of the bias lies. The racial component is coincidental to that, although I'm willing to be convinced otherwise. The important thing to me is that, as Brian said, you have a lot of people who are working very hard to get themselves out of the category of being poor and to get their children out of that category. And I think if you look at the total societal cost, whether it's for government services, whether it's for crime, whether it's for anything you want to look at, the most cost-effective thing for us to do is to help them in as many ways as we can. This program, administered by the FCC, is, from what I've seen, a rather cost-effective way to do that. And as best I can tell, even if there is some level of fraud, it's a round-off error rather than something that's a major component of the system. Therefore, if we're going to address anything in the system, it should be trying to smooth the edges off of the fraud rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Absolutely. Well, I hope with all the kind of controversy that's going on with this, they will at least reconsider and revamp the program instead of killing it off resellers. But we'll have to see what's going on and what happens before the 26th here. Well, hopefully the next topic here will not cause us to jump on any soapboxes. We've all heard about drones and helping the enterprise in many different ways. Now, Gartner actually estimates that over 170,000 commercial drones will be sold this year, and 58%, well, that's actually a 58% increase from 2016. Now, Goldman Sachs predicts that businesses and civil government will spend $13 billion on drones from 2016 to 2020. Cheap, ubiquitous drones have the potential to significantly increase efficiency in several areas. Now, PwC projects that globally, drone solutions have the high potential to replace $127 billion in current business services and labor costs across multiple industries. Now, they assume drones could have the biggest impact on infrastructure, agriculture, and transportation. Now, guys, I want to throw this over to you because, you know, there's a lot of industries today that use drones, and I'm sure that Cheaper, you've probably seen a bunch of these, right? Like you've actually had them in some of your studies too, right?
Yeah, well, drones are useful for all kinds of things. We put LiDAR on them and fly them off ships so we can measure millimeter wavelets, because that you know changes a lot of our instrumentation measurements and things like that. We've got another group that are using it with LiDAR and high-resolution images to fly over the volcanoes, to fly over the lava flows so we can map them and estimate the amount of flow. But I'm actually directly involved with another grant. We had a problem. The U.S. government, after World War I, decided to use Hawaiian waters as a convenient place to get rid of mustard gas shells. Bad stuff. But some of the captains or whoever were kind of lazy, and they didn't mark on the map where these dumps were. So the University of Hawaii was actually hired. We were actually going out, and for the ones that are marked, we're bringing them up, and we're putting them in special incinerators and burning them. But we have a drone that has a mirror and a high-resolution camera on it that flies out up to a kilometer offshore, and we fire a high-powered laser at it to bounce off the mirror, and it hits the surface of the water. Then the camera measures the backscatter, and we can do what's called Raman spectrometry. So we're actually measuring what's in the water to try and find the leaking mustard gas so we can bring it up and destroy it before humans are effective. Lots of really cool things are happening with drones, you know, seashore management, gas line inspections. Heck, why don't we go and bring up that there's a link down at the bottom. There's actually a church that's using a drone to inspect their roof. Now, we know how high some of these cathedrals are. And, geez, you know, that's a pretty dangerous place to go. Well, what this church did was they hired a company and worked with them, and they're actually using a drone with a high-resolution camera on it. And there should be a video someplace. I think it's down towards the bottom. Anyway, so they've got a big drone flying there, and it's inspecting the roof to try and figure out exactly how much repairs they need to do. And, you know, churches never have enough money, right? Oh, there's – so here's images that the drone's been, you know, moving around, trying to find out how much repair they need for that church. Of course, I'm looking forward to the drone footage from Padre flying his drone around the Vatican, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I'm actually – the interesting thing, I'm actually seeing some emerging markets that are using this as well. Like a lot of vacation companies – as well as real estates using them to kind of change the experience of buyers, where they can have them kind of experience the neighborhoods and the travel home during the day and during the traffic, and actually take you around the house and around the property. Also helps them kind of experience vacation spots and scenic spots, so they don't have to be there and they can kind of see the different scenery that's around the area. So it's definitely changing the way people are seeing things visually and experiencing things. Curtis, I wanted to throw it over to you. Like, how are enterprises maybe using this to help better their business, to help do things that potentially people and machinery can't actually reach?
Well, you're seeing them in a lot of different ways. I think it's fascinating because certainly engineering companies are using them. We've got, and it's a well-known story in this country, of the billions of dollars of infrastructure that need to be repaired. Therefore, companies are using them to get up and inspect bridges for possible rust and deterioration. I've heard about companies using them to inspect things like the distribution towers for long-distance electricity carriage. You're also seeing, there's a good example, because prior to this, you would actually have to put someone up there with a helicopter to get close and look at that. And that's a very expensive proposition, both in terms of the hourly rate of the person who goes up and climbs onto that tower and all the safety issues that they have to deal with, and the $2,000 to $4,000 an hour helicopter fee. You're also seeing them, though, for things like agriculture, where you're able to do surveys field microclimates. You're able to look at, as you pointed out, real estate. When we recently went through real estate transactions earlier in the year, we noticed a number of different properties where there were drone videos of the property that were part of the sales package. So there are a lot of different ways, and that doesn't even get into things like the materials application that I've seen from drones, where you actually hitch a hose to a largish drone, put it up there, and let it spray paint or some sort of anti-corrosive material or something else onto infrastructure. I frankly think we're very early in the commercial use of drones, and that the creativity of some of the engineers is going to be really impressive to get out there and see in the coming years.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think we're seeing many different applications, including delivery of supplies in areas that they can't actually get to. We're seeing bridge inspections and repairs being done with them. You talked a little bit about farming and agriculture, where they're figuring out where their herds are going, where their better feeding areas are at, factory monitoring, train track inspections, tunnel inspections, underground parking inspections. I mean, you just name it. And anywhere a drone can go that they prefer not to send a human, I think this is where the drones are going to actually emerge and start going. Now, we might see a bunch of emerging applications for these going forward. And I think Padre Este had it right, the quad father, where drones are where it's at. So we'll see how the applications are coming in the future. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we have a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But first, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's IT Pro TV. Now, there are a ton of training sites out there today that have content, but none of them really focus on the IT professional as well as IT Pro TV does. Now, whether it's certifications you're trying to get, CCNA, CCMP, MCSA, MCSE, MTA, and all the other acronyms that are out there, or you just want to learn about the latest and greatest techniques and technology, including programming and project management, IT Pro TV has what you need. Now, if you haven't already, go out and check out itpro.tv/enterprise because they dedicate themselves on helping you learn and grow in your organization and career. Now, recently, Glassdoor compiled a list of 15 top employers, including Google and Apple, and that they no longer require college degrees. Now, instead of those companies looking at candidates who have hands-on experience, they actually have hands-on experience through coding boot camps or industry-related training like IT Pro TV. Now, from CompTIA and Cisco to EC Council and VMware, IT Pro TV has you covered with everything you need to launch or grow your IT career. Now, CompTIA recently named IT Pro as its official video training partner. Now, over 4,000 of binge-worthy on-demand training and new content is added daily. Now, courses are conveniently listed by category, certification, and job role. You can stream IT Pro TV's courses live, on demand, and worldwide via Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PC, or by using their updated iOS or Android apps. Now, I can tell you at work, when I have a new team member start at the company, I have to find a way to get them up to speed on the latest and greatest. Plus, the others I manage want to stay up to date and on top of the latest and greatest. Now, IT Pro TV offers flexible online training for teams of all sizes. Plus, you can keep your team's skills up to date with interactive training that they'll actually enjoy watching. Now, engaging hosts actually present information in a talk show format. You'll have full control over your team's training schedule, and you can actually track your team's results via IT Pro TV's Pro Portal. You can see metrics like logins, viewing time, courses viewed, tracks completed, and more. Now, if you're ready for that National IT Professionals Day on September 18th, you can celebrate with an IT Pro TV subscription and join more than 100,000 IT Pro TV members today. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise and use code ENTERPRISE30 to learn more about IT Pro TV's team solution and to request a free team trial. Or sign up for an individual monthly membership with a free 7-day trial at itpro.tv/enterprise. Use code ENTERPRISE30 to receive a 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your active subscription. Now, standard subscriptions are normally $570 a year, but you only pay $399 when you go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use code ENTERPRISE30. Flexible training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results, IT Pro TV. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it now takes us into my favorite part of the show where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Dan Baird, founder and CEO of Wrench AI. Welcome, Dan. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, I'm actually excited to talk about AI, but first, our audience actually loves hearing about people's kind of journeys through the professional world. Can you kind of give us a quick trip through down memory lane and your journey through tech?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to kind of get into my journey early. Co-founded my first startup at 19, and it was a big beanbag chair company called Lovesack. And I got into the product development kind of role really quickly, and even before college, and it did really well. It actually, they IPO'd about a month ago. And my entire journey from there rolled into getting an MBA in entrepreneurship and global branding, and then I went and worked for Conagra in their launch space. And basically have been building and launching products in one way, shape, or form ever since, right? When I left Conagra, I went and worked in the crowdfunding space and co-launched about 60 platforms in various countries that were all doing different fundraising methods. So equity fundraising, Kickstarter style stuff, charitable fundraising. And I found it really married up with that kind of product launch background really well. We started to kind of develop programmatic launch paths that we started using for our clients in their launch process. And Wrench AI is basically the culmination of unifying kind of that bootstrap mentality that we had at 19 with kind of a lot of the strategy and the stuff that you see in really large enterprises, and applying artificial intelligence to product launch and better understanding your user population. So that's kind of the how I got here. Long, stumbling, and having a lot of fun with a lot of people that were all kind of trying to put their own dent in the universe. I found in that space, it's very easy to stay motivated, to want to keep doing it even when it's a tough day at work.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so obviously a lot of organizations have a ton of data out there, whether it's structured or unstructured data, whether it's sales data or whatever. I even know a bunch of organizations that don't even use digital technology to track their sales and so on. So they're kind of still using carbon paper type sales. Now, is it time for organizations to kind of look to digital transformation to better their business here?
You really have to. We're getting into a space and we're getting into kind of a day and age where the real battle is essentially won by who has the strongest relationship with their population. And that means relevant content. I mean, it's really kind of fun, quite frankly, for me to kind of see how the ad click side of marketing space has evolved. And essentially you're beginning to see user populations like new millennials that literally don't even see ads. They you ask them, hey, you know, did you notice, what did you think of that ad? They go, what ad? They have a filter that, you know, they're so bombarded by different kind of pop-up style advertising that it just doesn't even feasibly work anymore. And we've gotten past the states where a lot of people were basically saying, hey, content, 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 and just flood the web. We're now into a space of relevance, and it's understanding kind of who you're talking to and kind of how to approach them in a meaningful way. And quite frankly, if technology does its job properly, it gets out of the way and it allows those two people to kind of connect. You know, if you look at artificial intelligence, it's really a process automation tool fundamentally. And when implemented properly, it allows you to automate the research and automate a lot of the busy work that allows you to have that kind of meaningful conversation with an individual. And in our business and with a lot of the work that we're doing, a lot of the changes that we're seeing to kind of the finance space and a lot of the spaces that, you know, didn't necessarily think that they would be hit by AI. So example, like financial advisors, you see stuff like Wealthfront and like these ETF electronic funds trading bots that can essentially beat anybody that picks and chooses stocks. So their job's becoming a relationship management kind of, their job is to know their client, understand the risk tolerances and the life stages and what types of funds they want to be into. And that's how their job's evolving. They're not picking stocks anymore. Their job is to know people and to have a very good relationship with them. I think that's a really kind of positive direction for it to go. And obviously, like any technology, it can be misused, but I'd kind of like to see that relevance is really kind of the king of what matters now.
Right. Well, Wall Street, look out, I think, at this point. But I think another thing that you kind of pointed out a little bit is the fact that, you know, with AI, it actually can create a much more competitive market. Are you seeing that kind of trend where if you introduce AI into a business and actually some data analytics, it increases the competitive market for them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's research from Gartner that essentially, I think it's $2.1 trillion of business will be captured by those that adopt AI technology in sales and marketing processes. I mean, it essentially, depending on who you talk to, essentially those that implement AI when they're doing kind of this type of kind of customer relationship management work are talking about minimum of 2, but on average, kind of a 5x improvement in efficiency. It means that you're doing much more of the actual on the phone contact and the meaningful work, and much, much less of just, again, the busy work that just happens between kind of life, quite frankly. Those that adopt that type of a strategy are the ones that own tomorrow. And even a lot of companies right now, quite frankly, they're adopting this type of tech and tool, not quite frankly, even really understanding how they're going to use it, right? There's the buzzwords and the big data and synergy and whatever else, where a lot of people go, I don't quite understand what I'm buying. And quite frankly, there's actually a lot of skepticism on the businesses and the enterprise's behalf as well. Well, they'll say, you know, I'll adopt it, but I don't trust it. Definitely not yet. And there's almost always a cultural adoption of, we need to not just implement the technology, but we need to prove it works. And we need to give them some understanding of how it made some decision before they'll actually rely on it. So yeah, there's a lot there.
You kind of talked about it. You said, hey, this is the age of realization. We need to figure out, hey, we have all of this data. We have tons of data formats, text, images, video, audio, telemetry. You know, how should businesses be handling all these formats? Because they have this big data stream, and how can they make use out of it to actually better their business and better their scenarios and situations?
The real basic application that probably matters the most, in my opinion, comes from kind of behavioral application. It's the psychology. Like, with the internet is a tool that essentially allows the cost of switching from one product to another to be essentially zero, right? You have more options for more sources, and you have essentially no cost and very little time and interruption between switching from one product to another. You need to basically be ready to kind of adopt and really focus and understand kind of the behaviors around the individual, instead of, like, in the past, you would hear people talk a lot about, like, just demographics in general, like, what's our age and, you know, where do they live geographically and stuff like that. In the age of a really connected internet and an IoT kind of population, that stuff stops mattering. And, you know, for lack of a better term, the fetishes of an individual, the non-sexual, but the proclivities of an individual to find exactly the product that's tailored for them and them specifically has to be realized. So it really is about taking that data and putting it into a structure that helps you understand the relevance of your product kind of, and your category. So we oftentimes say, first things first, take the data that you have and focus on segmentation. It's boring, but it's ridiculously foundationally important, because it helps you understand, like, okay, of the population that we currently have here, how many of them would qualify as, say, an innovator in this space? They're, say, professional peers. They're the others that are actually so involved that they're actually tinkering on their own product because the one that they wanted doesn't exist. Beyond that, you know, who are the ones that are the influencers that actually have their own population and an education in this space? And who are the early adopters that are willing to stand in line if we launch a new product? And quite frankly, let's take that and then cross-reference it with who's happy and really unhappy with us in their kind of purchase decisions right now. If you start segmenting your population with your data and putting it into a framework like that, you can really do some powerful things, because what it does is it streamlines your ability to listen, which means you have a faster path to really understand that group, how to reach them, how to actually get their attention in a meaningful way, in a way that actually kind of reinforces a positive relationship. What I wouldn't do on the flip side is just aggregate a bunch of stuff that you don't know what to do with and let it either sit. So, I mean, you know, Brian, you mentioned earlier, data doesn't exist until it's in three places. And the other one is, when you're dealing with people's data in this format, you have to assume that at some date it's all going to get out somehow. So if and when it does, can you be comfortable saying, all right, what we did have was, one, really necessary. It had the proper security and protocols on it. And do we regret that it ever got out? You know, so, I mean, not that it is or will, but I don't know if there's a safer policy than assuming it's going to happen eventually.
So. Right.
Actually, Dan, well, I'd like to follow this up. So sure. Wrench AI is a service, obviously. Mm-hmm. And what do you deliver? Is this, you know, how do we train the AI? You know, I'm struggling with teaching IBM Watson how to identify fish species underwater, and that's kind of a long, drawn-out process. So how do you teach an AI to do CRM?
Let's see. So imagine that you can take – so as, imagine kind of a conversion funnel. Well, so wait, remind me. You were trying to teach IBM Watson what was the use case?
We've got underwater cameras, and we're trying to teach it how to identify fish species.
Yeah, that one's a little bit more difficult than this one. Let's see. In this context, let's say you're trying to sell that service to an enterprise in the user population that you have, right? In this context, what we would be doing is looking through your data and talking to, or in cases, looking for public forums like LinkedIn and other things, where we can actually examine the natural languages that people are currently using, and we're looking for cues that indicate that someone is actually walking or stepping through kind of a purchase or a buyer's journey in your space. We are looking for mentions that actually imply categorical level understandings of the underwater fish camera space, or at some point, maybe they've mentioned scuba diving or something like that. As they evolve and as they kind of travel through that purchasing decision, their language evolves. They'll move from categorical behaviors, you know, CRMs, they'll say really high. You'll oftentimes see your marketing team try to target and focus on words that are really big bang, big buck, but also really highly competed with terms. So underwater would be an example. As someone gets further into their category, and if they start mentioning, say, scuba diving or something else like that, you can start to understand that this person has a more sophisticated view and understanding of this product in this space. Now, if you can start combining all of the words and the terms that you guys currently use to describe this program, so it's everything from the cameras, the underwater, the fish species, and everything else associated with it, and then you examine the language and the semantics that your user population has from your database, either in interactions, from customer relationships, and customer support calls, things like that, you can actually examine and plug those into AI models that recognize, all right, where are they in this space? Are they using words and industry jargon that implies that they're very sophisticated in it, which means they're probably closer to a purchase decision, or are they still at the categorical level? Once we've kind of segmented that population, we start building campaigns that speak to each of them on a different level and a different basis, depending on who they are. So oftentimes, if someone's like an innovator in the space and they're really, really technically savvy with that type of a technology, we focus on more like feedback and other type of campaigns where we say, hey, did we get the vision right in terms of understanding this? Do you see any flaws in our methodology? Have we missed something physically? Like, you know, would you back us on our cameras and things like that? The same kind of thing, the tracks and the responses that you get start going into your neural nets, and they start becoming labels for, we took this feedback approach with this type of a person, which actually had even these type of personality traits, and they opened and or clicked and or responded. And now you have a framework for how you can actually kind of go to the next group and go, okay, cool. Let's talk to the people that are, say influencers, also pretty well versed in the same population. You can go with them, go, okay, look, we've already refined the product with our innovators. We're here to talk to you about helping us promote it. We can match them in the language they use, not just to your space, but say maybe the number of followers they have. So they're obviously celebrity. On top of that, they may be influential because they're writers and they're associated with editorial or other stuff, blogs, things like that. Same kind of thing. Different campaigns go to each of those to help you understand how can we actually help get the message out, right? So it's kind of a combination of using, in a lot of cases, triggers and events. And if you're using, say, images and other recognition, you're looking for basically being able to plot your product in a three-dimensional space and then understanding, based on your interactions with them, how close they are to it. And then using the segmentation that you get from where they are and what their professional job is, and if we've had any other transactions with them in the past, to turn that into a campaign of, all right, well, say this to that person from here to there. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. I think this is some cool stuff. But when we come back, I actually want to take us into a little bit how AI is actually helping security as well, and also maybe bring back in the co-host to talk some AI. But first, we want to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Grammarly. And so there's always a tool out there that you kind of keep coming back to. And for me, when I write, that's Grammarly. Now, not only does it help me write better content, but it also helps me with getting emails right too. Now, Grammarly will help you correct your writing skills by helping with grammar, phrases, and sentences. Even the free version helps with spelling Grammar and can literally help you be a better writer. Now, Grammarly adds Premium Edition as well, and that adds some great features. In addition to spelling and grammar, Grammarly Premium helps you with advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, and readability for different occasions. Now get this, 76% of surveyed premium users now find writing more enjoyable because of Grammarly. Now for me, it really does make it more fun. I trust that I won't send back bad content anymore because I can learn from Grammarly and its help. It integrates with Microsoft Word, Outlook, and they have extensions in all the browsers for Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Safari, and more. And there's a desktop app. And if you travel a lot, even if you take public transit and you like to work on your phone, Grammarly has you covered. It works with iOS and Android as well. Now, for me, on iOS, the Grammarly keyboard is a lifesaver. The autocomplete can sometimes fail you on those OSs, and it kind of sometimes makes things look kind of funny, and I have autocomplete fails all the time. Well, Grammarly keyboard can save you. Not only will it have you write better, it just looks better too. If you haven't tried Grammarly right now or yet, go out and get it now. It will literally make your writing and life even easier. Go to Grammarly.com/enterprise to get 20% off Grammarly Premium today. That's Grammarly.com/enterprise. And we thank Grammarly for their support in this week in Enterprise Tech. Well, we've been talking with Dan Beard, founder and CEO of Wrench AI. We want to talk a little bit about what Wrench AI offers. But first, I also want to talk a little bit about security. Like we got into how AI was helping customers and consumers in the space of better managing their data, making use out of that data. Dan, I want to throw over to you really quick. How does this also help from securing data from a cybersecurity standpoint?
That one's less my field directly. I'm more of the product side of this. But I mean, in many cases, a lot of the tools that you're using from those kind of data sources and a lot of those clients is building algorithms and training those algorithms to start recognizing leakage of PII, personally identifiable information, right? So you guys are familiar with GDPR from Europe, I assume. This is kind of like the large campaigns where they were basically looking to kind of lock down a lot of personally identifiable information. If you had someone's info, like what were you doing with it? Can they actually ask that it get deleted? Can they ask for copies of what you actually have? And a lot of this data is being used to program algorithms that start going through your structured and unstructured data and start refining it and looking for signals that they found something in, say, an unstructured, unlabeled data set that actually looks suspiciously like, say, the prefix to an American Express credit card or something like that. So in a lot of ways, the use of some of those data is once you understand, okay, here's what we learned about an individual and here's how we used it for segmentation, you can oftentimes be training neural networks that are using that same PII to actually find out, hey, look, we were able to use said information to reverse engineer an individual contact, where they lived, how to contact them, something else. And it's actually being used to program and help kind of lock down those security sources. So like as an example, Amazon has a new program, I think it's called Macy, but her entire job, it's a machine learning algorithm that actually uses a lot of the PII in your own data sets to help you recognize other PII threats. And that's everything from, credit cards, phone numbers, emails, anything that looks like it even could be something, they start alerting you that it's actually in those unstructured or other structured data sets so that in the event that there was some sort of hack or leak or something else, you would actually know, hey, we tried and did everything we did to prevent that. We could hash it or do whatever else we do to that data to secure it before it gets out. So,
Right. Now, Wrench AI actually has a bunch of features. They kind of target specific parts of businesses and maybe different kind of categories of businesses. Can you maybe go through some of them and how they're helping?
Yeah, well, primarily we're focused, as I mentioned, kind of on like people that are focused specifically in product launch campaigns. So oftentimes those are like enterprise innovation strategy teams or marketing innovation teams, people that are basically kind of building that launch strategy. We've worked a lot in the past on kind of crowdfunding campaigns. So we did a lot in terms of, again, setting up those platforms, and it's related to ICOs now. So they have to use a lot of the same legislation in the United States. And if you're doing an ICO and you're actually offering it to people in the United States, you're actually bound by a lot of the same rules that were generated by the Jobs Act. for crowdfunders. So we have a ton of expertise on that. We've worked with a ton of some of the more well-respected SEC attorneys in the country in terms of kind of what you can and cannot say. And when it comes to kind of doing equity raises in the United States, you know, SEC and FINRA have a lot of rules about what you can and cannot say, right? You guys have heard Elon Musk getting in trouble recently just for saying the wrong thing. And there's more rules than you can even imagine, right? We've had 11-page white papers that had to strike every use of the word can because they thought it was too forward-looking of a statement. But a lot of the companies that we're working with are in that position. So they're about to launch a new product. They're about to do kind of an enterprise fundraise or a Series A. And simultaneously, a lot of the focus from an industry perspective, largely it's been in a lot of fintech. We've worked with a lot of real estate companies and a lot of kind of commercial real estate firms. And for the most part, this strategy and the basic segmentation and the things that we kind of do on those initial stages don't dramatically change from an industry perspective. They're kind of industry agnostic steps. We rely on the companies that we work with to bring that industry expertise. And oftentimes, if we're programming and building kind of a launch strategy for a specific company, we deliberately give it to them incomplete. So it'll be somewhere between 50 and 80% done. And the reason that we do that is the ultimate final say of how this thing sounds needs to sound like you. The one thing you can't fake in this world is authenticity. So if we give you something that's almost there but incomplete, we've streamlined and we've simplified your launch, but simultaneously, we've still enabled you to retain the authenticity that is your voice, your product, your brand, if you want to call it that. And but most of the companies are in those phases, but industries, I've heard calls from everything. It's actually very exciting to get a lot of them because you can hear what people are really working on a day-to-day basis. But yeah.
Well, in terms of those things that people are working on, you know, earlier in our conversation, you talked about chatbots, basically, and chatbots that go through to learn what a customer looks like and what a customer in the a potential customer looks like. Given the state of artificial intelligence right now, do you see the best use of the technology being in this sort of fully automated use case or in a human assistant, something that amplifies a human's actions? In other words, to what extent does an AI engine today take the human out of the equation?
Yeah, in my personal opinion, a lot of people, at least in the a lot of the work that we do, they oftentimes call us hoping that they can step out of the equation. I can magically make a bunch of money and not have to do anything and interact with an individual. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. And I think a lot of the chatbots that you see out there for that reason, it's why they oftentimes kind of miss the mark. Automation, marketing automation done in haste really just falls flat. I mean, you guys know it when you see it and you see it from a mile away. The proper and I think the best application of these technologies is to really streamline the research and kind of like if you're about to interact with that individual, if you're about to have that understanding or conversation, yes, we can break it into smaller buckets. So like as an example, we treat it much closer to your second example of kind of a virtual assistant where we go through the population, we segment it, we look for kind of personality traits and other things that might suggest the best way to approach someone, but simultaneously break it into enough bite-sized pieces that one person can still do that work and again have the final kind of human touch there. I think most of the time when people try to completely remove themselves from the equation and have the entire transaction kind of flow through, I mean, obviously there's a bunch of businesses where that's the entire goal. But again, I think the businesses that really kind of totally remove the human element, and I think that's just bad news. There's a lot of ways where you still need to retain that. I mean, you'll see some of the best AI that I've ever seen executed. Its job was actually not just look and sound and type words on a page that actually looked human. It actually replicated kind of the interactions of even, say, breathing patterns and stuff, like the loading signals that you would see while your dashboard would come up would actually kind of mimic a human heartbeat to let you feel like you were interacting with someone that was much more kind of alive, if you will. Chatbots are very interesting. The ability to spin and generate content is very, very interesting because of the relevance in many ways. You know, when you can create, you can create 170,000 different positions for your specific product and target them individually to those individuals on a person by person basis. I think there's a place for it. But I think one of the ways we'll see our work change as kind of a general population, I think people will see more and more middlemen and the lower ends of the scale kind of taken out. There's going to be less busy work available, right? A lot of those kind of 1 second decisions will be left to, AI, but most of our roles will continue and evolve further to actually involve much more and more human interaction, person to person human interaction.
Well, in getting to that point, earlier you talked about providing an AI engine that was only partially trained because the customer had to do some training to make it seem more authentic and provide those cues that you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we know from previous examples like the famous Microsoft chatbot that they put on Twitter to learn, and in less than 24 hours, the good folks from 4chan had taught it to be, you know, a racist ass.
Yeah.
That AI can be mistrained. So what steps do you take? How do you go about making sure that the training that goes on, that very critical training, is happening correctly, and you're avoiding, you know, essentially training a monster?
Yeah. I think what you mentioned is kind of a good example of what a lot of people that would really like to be in a, you know, it's in our future, I'm sure, but that completely unsupervised learning where we kind of, you know, we unleash the bot, so to speak. It makes the decisions. We don't thoroughly watch it, but you'll see a number of examples where people kind of go through and they try to extract the hidden layers of how the AI was actually making its decision on an individual basis. And then when they saw, like, so for example, some guys use some kind of image recognition AI to basically treat an artificial intelligence bot to go through and recognize different species of dogs. They kept coming up with this kind of German Shepherd that it kept claiming was a wolf. And they went and said, no, Howard, you know, they tried to basically reverse engineer and extract the decisioning. So they basically said, you know, reverse and remove all the pixels in this picture that helped you make your decision. And what was left was actually no dog. It was making its decisions based on the background behind the dog. Kind of missing the point, right? For that reason, I think culturally the space, and this is kind of a current state of affairs, but I am a big believer in kind of supervised learning and human in the loop models that actually retain some sort of human along the way to double check what's going out the door. So before the last step, or again, as you mentioned, kind of even from our kind of cultural example, we really like making sure that a human is one of the final people to at the very least check that work and that label before they assign it. In really large kind of scale operations, sometimes they're going to be defaulting for the completely unsupervised learning and just see what happens. But I think that's where a lot of those kind of studies in the AI kind of sets itself up to kind of reveal how far we still have to go, right? Like a lot of the technology that you see and hear about right now still has, in many cases, you know, 30 years to actually be implemented and rolled out to the general population. And I think that we still have kind of that learning curve and learning and understanding how do we still interact and retain kind of a lot of that human, the insight and again, that human in the loop or that supervised training that kind of keeps it on the straight and narrow. So.
Now, real quick, I know we're running low on time and we have to close it up soon, but I do want to throw it back to you really quick. If an organization wanted to get started on Wrench AI, they wanted to get their data kind of integrated in and start using the tools, how can they get started? Where can they go?
Yeah, go to our website, wrench.ai, go ahead and kind of sign up for a conversation and a demo. We can sit down, we can run you through some of the graphs, charts, and dashboards and things that we've created for other clients and some of the recommendations that we've built for kind of either fundraising or other campaigns. But I would go there and start there first. And if they want, they can hit me up directly. I'm Dan@WrenchAI.
So. Fantastic. Well, folks, unfortunately, we've ran out of time. You've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise show, according to 9 out of 10 fish feces. I want to thank our panelists for dropping some knowledge on the Tri-Riot. Start with Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, it is always a pleasure having you here, sir. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
On Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. And my video is frozen, but that's fine. And I'm Chibert @twit.tv. Don't we just love Skype?
Thanks, Jeeva, for being here. We appreciate it. And of course, we want to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, you can always find my writing at Dark Reading. Got some interesting stuff coming up, and I will almost always point to new pieces on my Twitter feed at KG4GWA. If you've got any tips, anything that you'd like to see, you can also hit me up, Curtis at twit.tv. Would love to hear from the Twiat Riot.
Fantastic. And Curtis, I'm actually going to be at Ignite, so we'll have to sync up and have a coffee or something.
I will absolutely look forward to that, Mr. Maresca.
Sounds good. Well, folks, of course, we got to thank our guest, Dan Beard from Wrench AI. Dan, I wanted to give you a chance, 30 seconds, maybe tell the folks at home where they can find you, your work, and where they can find Wrench AI.
Yeah, same website, wrench.ai or Dan at Wrench AI. Go follow us on Twitter. Go hit us up on Facebook. Go to the website and go and sign up if you're interested both just kind of staying in touch and simultaneously. If you'd like to see what we've actually built for some others, case studies, go ahead and sign up and we'll get you a demo.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for being here. And of course, folks, we have to thank you as well. You tune in each and every week. We couldn't do this show without you. You are our loyal listeners and followers. We want to make it easy for you to tune in each and every week. And to do that, go to twit.tv/twit right now. So twit.tv/twit. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes and, of course, all the show notes and our information about our guests and all the articles we do. But also, right next to those stories and information, you'll see those magic buttons to subscribe your format of your choice, audio, video, HD video, and the device of your choice, whether it's phone, tablet, laptop, or desktop. And after you subscribe, go ahead and share the show with your friends and family and coworkers, because we love doing this show. And we can't continue to do it without your support. Now, after you subscribe, also remember we do this show live each and every week, 1:30 Pacific, p.m. Pacific, at live.twit.tv. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see all the behind the scenes, all the funny stuff. Of course, if you're going to jump in and watch live, also jump into the chat room live as well, irc.twit.tv. We always have great material and great discussions there, and we pull some content from there as well. So come and go ahead and jump in there. Also, don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. You can find out all of my work that I do for the Microsoft Office team at dev.office.com. And of course, look out for Microsoft Ignite content coming at the end of September here. So look out for that. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Thank you to Leo and Lisa for continuing to support us each and every week to continue to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. And of course, I want to thank our loyal producer as well, Mr. Brian Chi. Thank you for doing all the hard work and finding all the great guests and the content. Of course, make sure you hit him up on Twitter Sphere to potential content going forward. Of course, before we sign out, I have to thank our TD for today. Alex, thank you for filling in the show. We have to continue our tradition of the show. And what was the content of the show? What's the subject of the show today?
I believe it was like tools like wrenches and spanners and hammers or something, right?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Protractors, too. Protractors.
It was basically you should never underestimate your data. Yeah, maybe next time. Thanks, Alex. Well, folks, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.